going in this room.
Right.
The brushes with the, this with it. I just couldn't do that. I don't like to do it. Categorization is like violence. It is violence because everything is unique.
Categorization
is violence.
Yeah.
Is a violence.
Yeah.
It's a violence.
And then
children know that that's what they're saying.
This is exactly why Dolly. Yeah. Couldn't he was going, oh yeah, I do that. Yeah, I'm a writer, I'm an artist, I'm an athlete. Yeah. Yeah, there's no division with him because it was all life.
Yeah.
It was fabulous.
I showed them on YouTube, Dolly on What's My Line. Did I show you that?
Yes.
It's really fantastic. Yeah, I love the way he dug it. This is fucking incredible.
We force kids to do this, and we call it intelligence.
We call it education.
It's the simplest thing our brain does is to categorize, and it's the dumbest thing that we do. And I would sit there and tell them in graduate school, I said, you people are going to go teach school kids to do the most damaging thing they could possibly do and give them gold stars for this. This is what led some people to take soap bars and walk into the ovens. Mm. It's that kind of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Black and white.
Mm-hmm.
That's
the phonetic alphabet. Isn't when you read a book, I mean, this is an idea I gleaned from Bob a long time ago. I don't know if Bob would agree with it, but your eyes are tearing bits of information off the page. Mm-hmm. It's tearing knowledge apart into, shredding it into bits and pieces. And
I see it more like we talked about before, where I'm watching the candle melt and I'm listening to the music and I'm synthesizing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm synthesizing the print into a reality. I mean, to me, reading a book is like watching a movie. I'm in there. I'm in the movie.
That's what I do. User is the content.
Yeah.
That's exactly. And what he was saying about that, what do you call it? Tetrad. Is like, I think what he was saying is that McLuhan didn't really think that it was like a way of solving things, this categorization, because you can do it any way you want. Once you start doing it, you can pick anything. But it's some
he
way
said that recently?
Well, I don't know. I've got to read the quote where he got it. It was like Crystal, I think.
Who is Crystal?
The guy you were just with.
Oh, Andrew of that? Oh, okay, right.
Yeah. So he
because he's on the McLuhan list.
I was.
And then back on
now? One of the things that bothered me about the McLuhan list is it's so disjointed. People, I couldn't handle it because I'm going, do I know what they're talking about here?
Yeah.
Even if I knew what you were talking about, because people are writing off the list to each other and then suddenly they write it on the list.
That's the same with all lists.
Yeah,
well,
that's it is.
The
scattered
challenge. And I would get on a list and say, let's get this organized, folks, and follow the rules.
Put all the art stuff in one room.
And please put the subject. And if you're going to change the subject line. I'm so sick of the subject line never changing. I can't organize anything.
Well, see, that's because you're a victim of categorization in the syndrome. You actually do need categorization, but you want to do it in your terms, not the other terms. So you got a contradiction there. But that's something.
And if she categorizes it today one way, it'll be categorized a different way tomorrow.
Yeah, that's right.
That's what he's talking about.
Want to categorize it as it's happening.
That's my natural instinct, isn't it?
Very violent person.
It's
very good.
It's true.
It's like lying on a bed of nails.
Carol's directing it.
We need Carol in the camera. You know what, though? It's true that it is. I think it's instinctual. I mean, I think it's natural to our brain because we have to simplify to protect ourselves. Our survival brain says, I'm going to die if I get in that fire.
Remember when I said the Evergreen said, on the astral plane, there's too many dimensions, and they need to focus, so they come here. And you say, well, that's like here. Yeah, the mind is meant to separate things, though, because it's part of our sensory complex. The eye is one part. So, I want the butter, hand me the butter, And so you do that. But we don't understand that, this is Krishnamurti's point, that we expand, enlarge, and confuse that little mental function into something else, which becomes ideology and then problems.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And how do you make someone become aware of a useful instrument, but become aware of what its limitations serve and deserve.
Yeah,
that's the hardest thing.
And see what they're actually doing. See that they're actually categorizing like that. See that they're actually making these little split second. I just flashed on this when you were talking about that. What about the situation we're in today with so much information overload, which connects with my thing, why I have to get off at times.
Yeah.
All this information coming in, and I don't know what the hell to do with
this.
I know about this and everything else. And everybody is running around, so one of the reasons they go into the retrievals and one of the reasons they go into, this is what I believe, or join the Catholic Church, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, hey, I'm going to become a Catholic now. Right. This is real simple.
Yeah.
Now, when you ask me what I believe, go to the Catholic Church. That's what I believe. Let's not talk about that. It's settled.
Yeah.
Now let's go on to other things.
That's right. You know,
so I can do this with my life. I'm going around feeling very, very antagonistic if I have a belief, which so many people do, to everything else around them, because there's all these other beliefs going around, and they threaten their belief. The big difference between faith and belief is, like, if you have faith, you can live right now, in the now. That's why Marshall McLuhan had faith, because he did live in the now, they said.
Yeah, he was not the Catholic dogma. No. And that propaganda thing was trying to say, no, he's part of our dogma.
Yeah. But
they say quotes. That's why I wanted to go through and say, look, this quote is different from what they say it means. Yeah. You know, but we didn't get a chance. But anyway, you're right. I wanted to say that I always considered that I was doing Krishnamurti, and I wrote in my essay that led to Crystal's thesis, and which led me being out there. I said, McLuhan updated Krishnamurti. Because Krishnamurti is trying to make you aware of the mind. We'll call it the first nature mind in here, which is a mystery still, but we use it. Now we've extended the mind. That squares the confusion. And so McLuhan went past Krishnamurti. He says, well, yeah, there is the hypnosis of the mind, but we've extended. So we got two problems. And let's deal with the later problem first before we get back to what our organic mind is.
Don't you have the same problem that Krishnamurti had when you're doing that? Because people don't want to go to what you're doing. They want to go to what you're saying. The content instead of the state of mind.
That's right.
Which he's trying to get him back to see the state of mind. It doesn't matter what I'm talking about. I'm trying to get you to look at this thing. And so, you're trying to get people to look at the...
Right, but I would fascinate people because I wouldn't be obviously doing that. I'd be talking about the second McLuhan extended mind and playing with patterns in that. And then eventually they would always, if they got into it, say, well, what about my soul? Or what about... And then they'd suddenly recover their sense of their mind after they got tired of dealing with the mental extended patterns. And then I would be able to go into that part. But I would never start with that.
That's an interesting thing you could talk to Jerry about, too, these mental extended patterns as addictions.
Oh, yeah,
you
know,
Jerry. You've got all these people addicted to crop circles or this or that or the other thing, and they're real addicted.
Is that why you employ the metaphor of the evergreens?
The evergreens are another topic, because a lot of people are channeling, and they are actually the best channel around, so I always have the best of everything. You want to talk about media studies, you go to McLuhan. Most people didn't know about McLuhan, right? You want to know about top-down conspiracy stuff, the best guy, LaRouche. Most people had David Icke and stupid stuff out there. Okay. So I always provide the best source in different ways of looking at reality. Mm-hmm. And I had the evergreens. I used to play them on the radio. I used to claim that the subgenius axis, the aliens had come early and met with me, and I taped them, and I would play what my evergreen readings.
And so that's so I keep them certain elements.
Yeah, yeah. I
would and that's why they were so people like David were so pissed at you.
David?
Saint Albans. About
they
were really pissed at you because he really doesn't know this. You don't know even know Stang.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. I know Stang. I talked to Stang.
Yeah, yeah.
He doesn't know this guy, Bob Dawes.
Well, Stang, I had... But see, the thing is, he doesn't know I knew Stang. We had a debate on CKLN. There's a debate of me and him on the air. But the thing is that...
And you met him in Texas.
Yeah, met him in Texas. Carol was there. But the thing was... Krishna, there was another point. Oh yeah, one day in 93, I'd been on the Jettison Music, David Porter's show, and Jared and I went to see Tim Leary speak in some little place downtown. And that was after I'd been with Tim Leary, which I have. I can show you me and Tim Leary and Nelson Thal on a TV show here. I have it in my little collection. We got a TV to put it on, the DVD. But so we went to see him shortly after that. And then after
that wasn't it on Sunset Boulevard in a
might have been
upstairs it. in a restaurant.
And Leary kind of just leaned up against the wall, very casually took questions after showing his
video. I was there.
That's a new one. There you go. And you remember he showed his little hippie friends made a little DVD about McLuhan and Socrates. You remember the thing he showed?
Yeah, yeah. He was really starting to get into the
colonizing.
He was getting into the computer thing.
Yeah, he's talking about virtual reality. But do you remember that he showed the video, and you probably didn't know who McLuhan was?
I didn't recall that it was about McLuhan.
Yeah, it was all about McLuhan, and we had just done an interview about him. So he was interested in McLuhan, had been, and got retrieved. Hey, but Nancy, listen to this.
I'm listening.
So what happened was, after the show, we were walking around, and somebody mentioned me to the bartender. I don't know how it came up. And he goes, well, all of a sudden, I or maybe he just thought of it because of the discussion Larry prompted. Because I heard this guy on the radio last night, and he mentioned everybody. Mae Brussel, Christian Murray, McClellan, blah, blah, blah. And listen, of all the names I've been dropping to the show, and he says, it was incredible. He says, I love living in L.A. It's only in L.A. you hear something like that. Yeah. So I heard it. I walked over and said, hey, I was the guy you just talked about. So that surprised him, you know. Wow. And then we talked a bit. But that was one of my main memories, is he loved the fact that I could... He was watching me trigger off all these different memes, you know, mm-hmm. all these different areas of people and ideas, and he's impressed with this guy who could go anywhere you want to go. Oh, you want to talk Christian Murray? Okay, we'll do him. You want to do Mae Brussel? Blah, blah, blah. So that was cute hearing that. I mean, the guy just bursted out. He was bartending. Yeah, I heard this guy on the radio last night. It's incredible. He was all over the place. Mae Brussel, blah, blah, blah. And then his point was, I love living in L.A. Now look at that. He wasn't living in L.A. He's on the radio.
Yeah. Living in cyberspace.
Yeah, he's living in cyberspace, but he thinks he's in L.A. Yeah. And he could have heard it anywheres. And it's also sounded like he occasionally gets confused about why he is in L.A. And suddenly something like that. Oh yeah, that's why I'm here. You know what I mean? Because you can get confused in a big city.
Oh.
Yeah. You know, I wonder why you're here.
Yeah, he should have just said, I love being alive. Like that. Yeah. Was sad. Zappa used to yell that out at concerts.
Yeah, he says,
great to be alive.
He says, if you don't think it's fucking great to be alive, then this show will bring you down. It was a warning, you tell people. And Zappa could make it great to be alive. It's such good music. Mm-hmm. For me, anyway.
Yeah.
So what... Why did we get on to all the... Oh, the meeting. So that's the background, right? That's why you're here. We in the square pants. So next topic, Scott. I take another call.
Dude, wasn't there a connection?
Oh, I was describing with you. So what Scott did, Nancy, is we go through the book, and you can hear, it's like the director's cut. I'm commenting on what the book was supposedly meant to do, and we've done so many hours that it's all up on my website. You can hear it. You can hear our dialogues.
Wow.
Many, many hours.
Wow.
Yeah, what is it technically? We've got, is it 80 hours? Let me say it's 110 cassettes, and most of them are 90 minutes.
Well, after we finished and got up to the
chart,
we'd done 46, we'd posted right. 46 sessions, which were 90 minutes each.
The early ones a little longer.
The early ones were longer.
Going through the book?
Yeah. Yeah, we read every quote and we comment. Wow. He reads it. And he stumbles through.
So why don't you put that together as a book?
You mean transcribe all what we say? Well, you want to type it?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I have a really good typer.
Have her just transcribe. That'd be fantastic.
Then I'll get that kid that likes to go to the mall to type because he's really fast.
Actually, it'd be great if somebody edited it down. I think the audio doesn't need to be edited, but if it was going to be transcribed. In other words, it should be edited.
What you would do is transcribe our commentary, not the reading of the quote.
Right, yeah.
Because then you could just stick it into. I could give her the digital version of the book.
Oh, good. Right.
And then she'd put the commentary parts in there.
Right.
They'd read it.
And you could edit out some of my more dopey
quotes. No, they're taking audience attention. You don't understand. We need a dummy so the average person can think, oh, these guys
don't know what they're talking about. Yeah.
Not what?
They don't know what they're talking about.
But they need a human element. That's what they
That would work.
He's having the same trouble with Bob as I am.
Yeah. What? We're going to cook up an alien.
Fatal flaw.
Yeah, we'll get the fatal. We'll give him another name. Yeah, we'll call him Dr. Dean.
Call him the fatal flaw.
But the thing is that Scott would read it and stumble through. Then I'd discuss it, or he might stop halfway and say, "What's that mean?" Then when we finish discussing it, then I'd read it through real smoothly, real fast, and you could kind of hear what it meant because you'd heard me explaining it. So I like the stumbling through part because people are listening. If it was said smoothly, they wouldn't be able to keep up with it. But the fact that Scott stumbles along gives people time to stop and think about what has been said, you know?
But the thing is, if you're reading it, you don't need that because
you can
read it slowly. Right, that's what he's saying. We don't need to make you look that...
Right, we're just going to have the commentary. Yeah,
right.
That's right. We're just going to have
have his commentary.
And that
would make it much more available because you cannot come to everybody's house like you're coming here to teach us.
Yeah.
You know,
no, I come here to listen.
At a time.
I don't come to teach, I come here to listen and study the effects.
Well, We'll be careful. Be careful of our words.
Yeah, watch what you're doing. I'm studying you. I could bust you at any moment.
Watch out, his red light is on.
Yeah, yeah. So anyways, you got that
up. Usually he just drives me to sleep.
Yeah. She put up with us 40 years, for fuck's sake. I told her about how you went deaf first few hours of our meeting.
Do you have like tinnitus or something? Is that where that came from?
It's autism.
Listening to Bob?
Yeah, it's
not tinnitus. Tinnitus?
I had that too.
Because they asked me last night if I had ringing in my ears, and I said no. And I couldn't remember whether you did. I just mentioned that you had deafness over in one ear. But they can't stand the ringing. You got any advice for them?
Oh, I just interpreted it as dolphins talking to me.
Oh, okay. Well,
and you know what? When we showed up at the beach, on more than one occasion, the dolphins would show up when Carolyn was with us.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, when I'd rollerblade out to Malibu, I'd always stop. Wherever I'd stop, I would see dolphins. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Do you ever go out in the water in Hawaii?
I did, but I didn't do the dolphins.
Didn't see any dolphins?
I forget where I was, and I did sort of pet some dolphins now, but I haven't swum with them yet.
We used to go out fishing when I lived in Hawaii. We used to go out about, we had this little 60-foot boat. Three of us would go out, we'd go out fishing. And they're very
friendly. Yeah.
Friendly and playful.
Yeah. One time when I was in Ventura, actually, in California, at a magnesium conference, we went out to do whale watching or whatever, and we saw some whales in the distance, and on our way home, hundreds of dolphins, hundreds, circled the boat and swam with us.
Yeah, they love to play around your boat.
Cool.
It was amazing.
It's amazing when they come out. They can just twirl and go down. They just come up and twirl.
Let me tell you a neat surfing story.
Okay.
I don't think I told you about this. So the guy I visited, the McLuhan Scholar, he's a surfer.
Uh-huh.
He's a good surfer, and he's lived in his family's cottage on the beach, a place called Whangamata, Whanga. We'd say Whanga, Mata, Whangamata, but the Maori say Fang, W-H is F. So it's Whangamata. So we're in this Whangamata beach, go surfing every day, and every now and then, Ned would want to watch a movie with me to see what kind of Xenocrony. You want to experience movies Xenocrony. You know what I mean?
Did you see I'm Not There?
No, it hadn't come yet.
Oh, okay.
We saw a little trailer when you sent, maybe, we saw a little trailer of it,
yeah.
So we know about it.
Okay.
But, so he got the Transformers. So we put on the Transformers, which I could have watched on the plane going out to...
I tried to tell you that was a Bob movie when I saw it. I called him up, I said, Bob, Transformers, it's all about Bob.
So Andrew, he's hoping he's going to see Bob in a movie, you know, with Bob sitting beside him in his own cottage. So I missed seeing Transformers on the plane, 12-hour flight from San Francisco to New Zealand, because it was listed, but... I didn't watch Hairspray and the other stuff. I was waiting for Transformers, but it never came up, and everybody fell asleep. I don't even know if they played it, but I fell asleep eventually.
Mm.
But I was up later than most people. So anyways, because I think Shannon told me, look at Transformers. Shannon, my foster daughter, was upset about Transformers for some reason.
Mm.
And the kid violence or something. And never got figured out. I didn't know what she was talking about then. I don't know what she meant, so I may be wrong. We don't stigmatize her, not getting it. But, so Andrew, we go to the store and a friend lent him Transformers ripped off the net, you know what I mean? And so he wanted to watch it, so so we sit down. It was unfucking believable. It's literally about the D-cell. It's about me, unbelievable. And like Andrew was really good. We just wanted to go, see the 22? He was seeing the numbers in the license plate. He knew what to look for, you know? There was all this shit. And it became so, he couldn't believe it. Probably it started to spook him after a while. It was so literally me. And it probably resonated with things we'd done that day. You know what I mean? It was like right there. So that was amazing.
But the end, it shows the ape. AP over the AM.
That's right. No, he was going AP. He says, that's AMAP. It was 22 versus 23. The 22 guys were the bad guys, and the other, the 23, they actually had the numbers. And at one point, right behind them is this this big code, 322, which is Skull and Bones, but that is 22 and 23. And it related to Robert Anton Wilson, who was 22. That came in somewhere in there. It was just unbelievable, the xenocrony. Even I was impressed with it. You know, usually I know this is going to happen. Well, I don't know when it's going to happen, but usually when people tell me about a movie, that's probably going to have it. Mm-hmm. But it was just fun for Andrew to... It was fun for me. I'd never seen anybody so... Bob knowledge-wise, know what to see when it happened. Mm-hmm. Like he was seeing things before me. You know what I mean?
Was this his first time through, or
he'd never seen it? Oh, no, wow. He'd never seen it. He didn't know what it was about. But
who's the director or producer?
I don't know
who put it together. Oh, okay. So yeah, no, yeah.
I don't know anything about who did it or anything.
But it's a kids' movie.
No, it's adults. It's 20 years ago, like Anna was a kid. The kids had Transformer toys.
Right. Yeah.
They were machines.
We started out, you made them out of Legos. You could build robots.
Yeah, okay.
And then they started building them so that they had kind of movable parts
and stuff.
All those
little plastic toys. That they could be a car, or they could be a jet plane. Or
Transformer.
Right.
That's like
what
it is. Right.
Yeah. It's
like shape-shifting.
Yeah.
Decades ago.
Yeah.
And
I got a trunk full of them in the basement.
Because you bought them at the time?
No, I buy them at garage sales for a nickel, quarter, whatever.
And why?
Because they're... Why do I like smoke?
Oh, you work with them? You touch them?
I play with them. I'm just amazed that there's such an array of them.
Oh, yeah, right.
And they're laying on people's lawns and driveways at garage sales for a dime.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
The complexity of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, Carolyn, it's actually about machines turning into being humans. They can transform human, train, be anything they want, and they fight among themselves. So it's a battle of the parts of the android meme.
Oh, my God.
It's literally that. And... But then the AP factor comes in, where the Andromeda shrinks.
Mm-hmm.
But so there was the bad aliens who were bad machines. They were number 22. They were actually like 22 of them, or they were called 22. It was unbelievable. And the others were the 23 guys. And I think right at the crisis point, the number 22, 23 comes up. It just, so there was the numbers, but the concepts were totally Bob. AM versus AP, and who's going to win?
Mm-hmm. What's the AM AP?
Android AM is Android Meme.
Android Meme.
AP is first nature. What humans think, anthropomorphic, what we project in reality,
okay.
We think the reality is something to do with us.
Mm-hmm.
The anthropomorphic physical, every culture has a content or a paradigm about what they think they are as the center of the universe. It's sort of like saying the anthropomorphic physical is that part of the human that says, I'm not a tree, I'm not an animal, I'm something else.
I am me.
We're kind of unique or feel something about ourselves. We're self-conscious. I don't know what you want. The sense of being human.
Self-awareness.
Yes. So I say the android meme, as it shrinks, it's recovering humans confronting their own self because we've been distracted by the extensions of our own self for thousands of years.
And we've lost a connection to the greater life.
Well, we don't assume that. We may always had connection or we may never get it. I don't make that assumption. We've just been mutating within our second nature stuff.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
And it's all an extension of the original first nature or whatever that is. But we think we are something.
Okay.
You know?
Okay.
And we may not be what we think we are, right?
Yeah, sure.
And
why would you call it anthropomorphic physical?
Because anthropomorphism is you project a human thing into the...
It's a totem pole is anthropomorphic.
Yeah, totem pole that you see in nature. You say animals are representing parts of us.
Mm-hmm.
It's a projection by human thinking that there's human aspects in the external environment.
Yeah, people do it all the time with their animals. They give the animal anthropomorphic attributes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a simple mental projection, which people did probably from the beginning. But these machines and technologies are more complicated projections by humans. You know what I mean? They're extensions of it. Anthropomorphizing is extending yourself into the environment,
right,
or responding to it extending into you.
Mm-hmm.
So that interplay of cognition.
So it's not just seeing the humanity in something, it's seeing how humanity projects onto the external.
We love our cars and TVs because we think it's us.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And Ed and I discovered a whole new thing called parapet, but that's another topic.
Parapet?
No, pets. Media, as they become smaller, like iPhone, little cute thing that has all of it, they're little pets now.
I've got this stick, you know, this tiny little stick that has a gazillion megabytes. I can put, you know, download
everything.
My backup on.
Oh,
it's crazy.
Right.
Crazy.
You got that from Ed?
No, I just bought it to back up I was traveling.
Okay, so watching the Transformers, mm-hmm. this is that's just not the story I wanted to tell you about the service. So, But for me, it was a delight to have someone who knows me, my mind well enough, knows the interpretation, and was pointing out stuff. Now, because it was a crummy ripoff, and his computer, we couldn't put a headphone in, I couldn't hear a lot of it. You know, it was going by too fast or something. But there's so much action, it doesn't matter. I would go back and listen to the fine dialogue and get even more out of it. The anthropomorphic Bob, you could call it Bobomorphic projections.
Right? Bobomorphic, that's what
I'm accused of being too Bobomorphic. It's
true.
Not about you, Bob.
Yeah,
you
know. That's true.
So I got the drift of it, and it was just great him commenting on it. But he was shocked. He couldn't believe how obvious it was, you know? He says, so fucking, he goes, Bob, who the fuck is watching you in Hollywood? Are we being taped now, Bob? He's like, yeah, we're being taped. And so he kind of got a bit nervous. He says, well, will I get hurt? Nah, you're lucky. You're doing it with me. I protect you. There's no problem. So he relaxed, but what was it? He then said, well, Bob, who the hell is doing this? Who's the one who knows all this about you, who sticks and moves? Who's running this whole thing? And I wouldn't tell him first, and he kind of persisted. I said, well, I'll give you one of the guy's names, Joe Dunn Sloan. Now, the transformer is about the D-cell. You see, it's about the fucking little D-cell. Do you realize that, Scott?
I didn't make that connection.
You didn't, the little cube. The little square.
Okay.
That was the secret to everything, or it had this energy. It's a D-cell. Anyways,
square. Okay.
Yeah, it's a little square cube.
There was a square cube in a movie that you liked that was about these two kids. It was another kid's movie.
The last FMUB about UFO.
Yeah.
It's a weird one. It takes place up in Seattle.
I remember the cube.
The last MZ or MIMSY.
Last MIMSY.
That had a little D-cell. Can you hold it?
Sure.
Let me just get the point. That point about the. So he says Joda. I said Joda and Sloan. So of course, overnight he goes Googles Joda and Sloan, and I'm telling him the inventor of the D cell, who is not the name of the guy that's running the show now or parallel and competing with me. So I just gave him this the name, and so he Googles it and finds out it's about the D cell, and he doesn't complain. He doesn't complain to me that I lied to him, or you know, isn't making or that. Well, how could this guy be running it if he's dead? You know, because Joe's dead. So he didn't make an issue out of the name. But when we uploaded the Tom Brennan stuff and the Everest disappeared on the net, he posted it was by Joe Dunn Sloan. We use this as his cover name now.
Oh.
And he thinks he's being the most powerful guy in the world in some way, you know.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, so
now he's creating.
Yeah, he's working with it.
You provided him with the persona.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that's what's good about him. He didn't get all pissed off that I didn't give him the name of the guy, but it was a name, and he liked it.
Wow.
So, a couple days later, he wanted to watch another video. So we go to the video store, and I don't know what we're going to watch, and I pick this one, he says, no, and he says, no, maybe that. Then he wanted one, I said, nah, I don't want that. Then he goes, this is it. And he takes it, and he shows it to me, and it's called The Bra Boys, B-R-A. Nothing to do with the female bra, The Bra Boys. It's a documentary on the surfers in Australia. So I said, well, okay, we're doing surfing here. I'm at Andrews Surfing School. Okay, let's watch this. Okay, so we go home, we put it on. And it's a documentary about Maroubra Beach in Sydney. M-A-R-O-U-B-R-A. Maroubra Beach. Right in, is part of Sydney, on the water. And it's a ghetto. And it goes into all these surfers, tough, gang-ridden surfers, who are fantastic surfers and very tough, but they are harassed by the police, they gang fights with people who don't like surfers. So it's a tough world. Now, you've ever seen the Z Boys, about the skateboarders who began down by Jerry's place? You ever seen that documentary, Z Town, the Dogville or something?
Dogville, I heard it.
Right, you know about that, Scott?
No, that.
Yeah.
Did you see that documentary? It's a really good documentary of these young boys skateboarding down by Jerry's and how they began. And they're all tough kids, right? And they're wilder than the suburban kids. So at the competition, they freak everybody out because they're really all over the place. Mm-hmm. So I had seen that. So now I'm looking at this documentary on the three Everton brothers. Maybe there's four. Sonny, Kobe, and two other guys. And they... Well, I was saying this to you at Nancy, so you've heard this.
I'm listening.
Okay, I mean the other Nancy.
Nancy Shaw.
Yeah. But I want Scott to hear this. So the what happened is that one of the boys went home one night, and the father, who was a junk, the mother and father were junkies and prostitutes and totally ridiculous people, and they got mad at one of the brothers and kicked him out of the house. So he goes down to the beach and complains to his older brother and that, hey, what? They said, don't worry, we won't go back there. We'll go to our grandmother's. So they go and hang out with their grandmother, who becomes the mother for everybody, all these fucked up kids who got no parents or anything, you know. But they're all fantastic surfers. And so Kobe, he's like the best of the four. The only other brothers got involved, the psycho in the group, who was going to rape a girlfriend and try to involve one of the Everton brothers, but the Everton guy at the last minute pulled the gun away from him, shot, and the bad guy got killed. So the Everton boy got put on trial. And he was put away in jail for 20 months waiting for trial. And then they accused Kobe, who was the really good surfer, of helping his brother. They were going to put him on trial. And it was all... So while Kobe's on trial, you know this guy Kelly something, the great surfer, Kelly somebody over the last 10 years? Kelly somebody.
No.
Kenny or something. He comes to for a competition at Maroubra Beach. And so Kobe's in trial in the morning, gets off at noon hour, runs down to the beach. He's got an hour and a half, and the whole local community wants him to face off with the world champion. And they're going to do it on his home turf. So they all were gathering and cheering, and he comes down, and he gets out there, and he just whips Kelly. I mean, Kelly can't handle the surf or something, and this guy, he wins. Kobe wins, beats the world champion. And so he gets off the beach, and they do a big arch, and they walk through the gauntlet, and praise him and all that, and everybody's cheering. And he runs back to the court.
Yes, back to the court.
He wins the championship in the fucking in the interval, noon hour race.
Lunch, the hour and a half lunch.
Yeah. And so it was all a setup, and the guy shouldn't have been in trial, but there was big anxiety for the family, and the idea was the mother, the grandmother, who had had a heart attack and couldn't talk really anymore for a few years, they wanted her to get out of the anxiety of whether her kids are going to go to jail or not before she dies. And so they get out, and so the end of the movie, they get released, and everybody's happy, and the mother, grandmother experiences this and then dies. So it's all about these kids and how they surf and how tough they are. So then the Everton brothers started going out to the thing you sent me, the tow-in surf. You know, the giant waves, and you have to be get onto it by a boat.
Ski boat, yeah.
You have to be given
like North Shore.
What?
Like the North Shore.
Yeah. And so these guys, the Everton brothers, they go around the world looking for the most dangerous places in the world. And there was a place called Cyclone or Cyclops. So, you know the Cyclone? Cyclone? Does that mean anything? Mm-hmm. What it was, when Andrew saw it, the wave was, it was like, looked like the Terminator when he becomes metallic.
Oh,
it was so sheer and cold and powerful, It was like metallic.
Yeah, I've seen that.
And Andrew goes, holy shit, it was making him freak, you know, because he's thinking he's going to surf.
Laird Hamilton was surfing that wave, I believe.
Right, yeah, well, I don't know, these guys might, they didn't even, people didn't even know where it was, they went to wherever it was, and they had to check the map and figure out where it was, and maybe it changes a bit, the terrain. Anyways, they go out and surf it, and you're surfing on rocks, with big waves, with dead sharks right there. You're surfing among sharks with rocks! I mean, these guys are so tough, because they grew up that way.
Sharks are dead?
No, they're alive.
I thought you said dead. I'm sorry.
No, the point
deadly
is
sharks.
Deadly sharks. And so they're out there filming it and surfing it and celebrating. And they also went somewhere else. And a whole bunch of them went, or I don't know why there were others, but they were all getting smashed up. And this one guy he has a hole in his neck, and he's and the camera comes up real close, and he goes, "See that?" And then he goes like this, and I guess it stopped bleeding, but it was a big gash in his neck. He got smashed on the rock, and he's there still surfing. He'll go to the hospital later.
Shark bait.
Yeah, he'll go to the hospital later. Oh, that's another factor. When they were at the shark place in Cyclone, Kobe got his wrist fucking torn apart. Okay? And so he's bleeding, and they're wondering, should Kobe stay out here? Because the sharks will be here in 5 minutes with the flood. And they said, ah, fuck it, let's keep surfing. Kobe's dripping blood all over the place, and they're ignoring it. And then they eventually tie it up, and they take him to the hospital.
I got a hernia tape in.
Did you get any? Did you get all of that?
All of that was in, but I just now have to open
that's,
it.
You know, when
you got to see this.
When you're telling this whole story, I'm thinking, you know, like the guy's his life's on the line. He's in court.
Yeah.
And he, in that hour and a half court lunch, you know, what a tremendous amount of slack his psyche has. But the internal, it's internal slack. I mean, he's got this, he could just...
Detachment.
Detachment, yeah. Right. He can go from this life-threatening thing to this other joyful life-threatening thing.
And focus on it and win.
And win.
Yeah, I'm standing here listening to this thing about these surfers, and I'm thinking about, you know, people think about surfers and totally stupid.
Yeah,
guys.
Yeah.
I mean, is this what happens? The surfers, they all start thinking like you.
Yeah.
You know?
No, that's what the movie's about. Is about how they all know there's worth, but the whole community, the police, they all hate them. They're just bums, you know.
Yeah.
But they have this big commune.
Wow.
And so they show them when they take breaks, when they party, they get up on cliffs, and they put some kind of protection on, and they set themselves on fire, and they run and leap over into the ocean. So they're flying in the ocean, totally aflame, and then it gets put out. And they're doing all this crazy, like, chicken stuff, driving cars, to the max, way beyond it. They showed them occasionally they break up, they start partying on the street, and they stop the local buses, and everybody's trying to get somewhere, and they're dancing around, stopping the bus, they get up on top and party on top of the bus, and they're all cheering, and the bus eventually starts moving. There's about five of them on the top, and yeah, rocking the heavy metal music, and that. You know, total juvenile delinquents on
what movie was this?
Bra Boys. You got to see it.
Okay, yeah.
Bra from Maru Bra Beach.
Okay.
So, I was watching this. This is very interesting anthropology, watching this, you know. And it was made by Sonny, the older brother, I think. So he was a movie celebrating his grandmother and the community and the surfing and the trial and all that. And it was big news in Australia, you know, in Sydney.
Spell bra?
B-R-A. What? Okay. Maru Bra. I think of marooned. These are kids marooned in poverty. Mm. So Maru Bra Beach. So that was that. That was interesting. But then I go I fly out of Auckland early in the morning, get to Sydney around 11, and I'm supposed to fly to LA around 4 in the afternoon. So I got a long wait. But by 11:30 they tell me that the plane's canceled. Because the jet we're going to use came from London, which had ice. It was cold in London. So they couldn't continue using it in Sydney because they had to repair the ice potential damage. So it couldn't be used till the next day. So we all had to stay overnight in a hotel.
Was there some kind of weather catastrophe just before you left?
There was various. There was the Fiji cyclone. Which we got some of the waves eventually from that, about 5 days later. But there were two earthquakes as I left Auckland, New Zealand.
Yeah, I saw that on the news.
Okay. Yeah, there's two of them, one night and one next night.
Because I remember, I said, God, Bob, I wonder if Bob got out okay.
Yeah, I got out, we were driving around the night before, went down to see Scott Eastham, his thesis advisor, and it was the night, a very rainy night, there was an earthquake up where the cottage is. Mm-hmm. We were a bit south. So then, heard about that the next day, then I flew the day after that. And I met at the airport in Sydney, and these people come in, they start watching TV. And I'm looking at them, and so then I mentioned went over, and they were reporting an earthquake. So I go, is that the earthquake I heard two days before? And I'm wondering, I can't figure it out, so I eventually go find those people, and I said, because they had just come from Auckland. Where did that earthquake happen? Bay of Plenty? They said, no, it happened in Poverty Bay. I said, well, there was an earthquake in Bay of Plenty the other night.
Bay of Plenty, Bay of Plenty.
Yeah. I said, there was an earthquake in Bay of Plenty the other day, and they confirmed, yes, we know that one. I said, this is not it. They said, no, it's a new one. I said, the other one was only 4 point something. They said, no, this was bad. This was 6.8. And I said, when did that happen? She said, just last night. So there were two earthquakes. As Bob withdrew from New Zealand, the fucking country couldn't take it. So
how was the meeting? The Andrew's thesis advisor.
It was very good, but that's another story. So what happened is, the plane got canceled. So I got to go to a hotel. So I'm stuck here for 24 hours in Sydney. When I was flying out to Andrew 3 weeks before, I thought, shit, I got to wait 5 hours before I go to Auckland. If I could go drive around the city and see Sydney, because somebody in San Francisco told me, hey, man, you go to Sydney, go up on the bridge. Go way up the tour of the top of the bridge, incredible view. So I thought, well, he's embedded something in me, you know what I mean? So then we were stuck there for many hours on the 3 weeks ago, and I think I got 5 hours. I should go get a cab and drive around the city. But I found it was too hard to do the customs thing and go back out and come back in and say, fuck that, I want to take my shoes off and be investigated and all that shit. They always take me aside lately and investigate me. So I won't do it. So I forgot about seeing Sydney. But now I'm held over coming back 3 weeks later, right? I said, yay, I get a whole day in Sydney. So I just get on the subway and start above ground seeing Sydney and then going underground. And I said, well, where can I go? Maroubra Beach! So I find out where to go, and I get the bus, and we're driving along for a long time. I think the bus said Maroubra Beach. So eventually I come up to the woman bus driver and I said, will you let me know when we get to Maroubra Beach? Thinking we'd stop, she'd keep going, I wouldn't know. She says, no problem, that's where we stop. I said, okay, good. So she found that very funny that she could say, yo, no problem telling you where it is, because we stopped there. It's the end of the line. So we get there, and say goodbye to her, and I walk out, and there's the beach, totally familiar from the movie. And you're looking down on it. It's a pretty amazing beach. And really good waves, and body surfers, and board. They're all out there board surfing. So I walk up on the cliff to see back a bit to see how far it extends. Turns out it was just this half moon. But I'm way up there, I look over the sea, but it's all rocky there. So I walk back down, and I go over to a little store, 7-Eleven, kind of local store, but not 7-Eleven, to get a drink. And I'm in there, and the guy says, so are you from around here or something? I said, no, I'm from New York. And he said, how long are you staying here? And I said, just 24 hours. And he said, oh, that's good. And then I said, do you know the Aberton brothers? You ever heard of the Aberton brothers? He goes and he looks, and two guys walk into the store, and I see him look at them. He like looked at them knowingly, and I looked over at them, and I go, "Are you the Aberton brothers?" And then they go, "No." And then everybody started laughing. Anyway, it's just cute the way the guy. I ask him. He looks over. Two guys come in. It looks like my kind of synchronicity. Just have walk in, right? Could have. They just walk in right there when Bob's requesting their presence.
It wasn't them.
Yeah, no. So I turned and said, "You the Aberton brothers?" But they went knowingly. No. They went like that. Yeah. Almost like they were.
They knew up.
But they didn't look like him. But they went like, no. We're not. We don't want any publicity. And so I looked at them and him, and it was all the ESP, conspiratorial ESP going on. And I looked, I said, no. He goes, no. So we kind of canceled. We kind of came to a compromise that they weren't the Aberton brothers. But it was all weird and funny, you know what I mean? Yeah. So that was absurd. And so I go outside, and I can't open the ridiculous drink cap. You know, it's all twisted, there's many layers. And so I had to get some people to help me open it. But I didn't want their dirty hands to touch it, because I'm going to put it up my mouth. So I had to get them to show, don't touch it. How do you do it? You're like, don't touch it. Just tell me how to do it. So we're all laughing, then realizing, yeah, he won't let us touch it. So you kind of got to go like this. Yeah, go like that. That twist. Okay, I got that up. Now what? Well, now you got to do the next part. Give that off. It was totally overdone, this cap, you know. So eventually I got my drink. So I go down there and I watch the surfing for an hour. And Andrew taught me how the etiquette goes on out there, how the surfers surf. And there's a hierarchy. There's a whole thing of how it's done. You can't all just go out there. and get in line, sort of a line, but it's not. It's based on when the wave comes in, and if a couple guys go for it, they immediately got to recognize, oh, he got it, I didn't, and you got to back off. You know what I mean? It's very like tactile involved and living in the moment and adjusting. So there was other things like that. And he showed me how to see the riptide and where it's dangerous. I almost got killed one day on the beach. I was being dragged out and didn't even know it, and I didn't have my flippers on because I had a smaller thing. And Andrew had to swim out and get me. I didn't even know I was being swept out. I was too busy trying to get the big wave. Didn't know that I was being dragged way out. So he had to come out, and he's a good swimmer, and he had to push me in, and then we kept getting dragged out, and he kept swimming and pushing me in, and I'm trying to go, and I got no power because I haven't got my flippers on, you know. So it was pretty weird, but anyways, then he showed me what had happened, that the riptide will get, actually where it's flat and nothing happening is the dangerous part. Mm-hmm. Here comes James, and so I was being dragged back out. Give him the radio guy. Come on in, James.
Oh, wow.
This is Terry.
How are you?
Nancy? Full on. Okay. So have you met Carolyn, James?
No.
This is Carolyn.
Oh,
nice to meet you. Nice to meet you.
How is he?
Oh, thanks.
I'll take a coat.
And this is Scott.
Hi.
Yeah, like right into the boardroom meeting.
Sort of. So we're talking about this surf story I experienced in Sydney.
Oh, yeah.
I got held over for a day.
Yeah.
So we'll fill you in later if you need it. But the back, what's happening is I'm now gone to the beach to see the surfers. And they made this great documentary called The Bra Boys. So I'm now there looking at where they came from. And what was the last thing I was saying? So I'm watching the surf. And I'm trying to think about it like Andrew taught me out in New Zealand, the riptides and the surfing and how they do it. So after about an hour of doing this, I say, well, I know enough now. I'm going to go find the Aberdeen boys. So I walk over to the surf club. It's the Surfing and Lifeguard Club. Biggest. They had a tourist map you could see, and they give the history of these various buildings. So I go over to the surf club and knock on the door, and nobody there. It's locked. So eventually a young woman comes, opens the door, and I said, I guess you got to be a member to come in. She goes, yeah. I said, well, I'm not a member. Do you know if the Aberdeen brothers are around today? She goes, no, I haven't seen them today. So I said, okay, thanks. So then I went walking off. Now, all this was being done because I was looking forward to emailing Andrew to say, hey, man, I went down to Brabrew Beach and was looking for the Aberdeen brothers. That was the whole point, right? Mm-hmm. For me to tell Andrew what happened. And so then I go back and look at the surfing, and a guy comes along, a surfer, he just come up. And I said, have you seen the Aberdeen brothers today? No, I might have said, have you heard of the Aberdeen brothers? Oh, yeah. And I said, have you seen them today? No, that's not right. Do you know of the Aberdeen brothers? He says, yes. And then there's a pause. He says, yeah, they used to surf. Terry, where are you? Come on in.
I'm directing him, too.
Oh, I didn't want to walk in front of the camera, but that's all right.
Okay, so you can sit over there, though. So the surfer, there's a pause. And he goes, I might have indicated, are they around today or something? He goes, well, he used to surf here when they were kids. And so I said, well, from that guy's point of view, they ain't going to be around. And I thought, well, that makes sense, because in the movie they're doing now going around the world, they're professional surfers, they do tow and surf, they do dangerous surfing, you know, so in a sense, maybe. So I got a sense from them, from that guy, that they're a legend but not really around anymore. They might be. So I'm thinking, well, I won't tell Andrew that part, you know. So then watch that, and then these skateboarder maniacs came along, and I was sitting here on the bench, and they were skateboarding, like right here along this edge of a thing. So they were all leaping in front of me, right here, they're kind of, I don't know, they might have thought, well, let's just see if this tourist will freak out. But I kept sitting there, they were right in front of me, you know, falling off their skateboard. So I watched them for a while and looked at the surface through there. So then I went and got back on the bus and went downtown and decided to go to a movie. So I ended up seeing two movies because I snuck in the second one. Went back to the hotel, saw another movie, then saw another movie the next morning, and then on the plane saw three movies. I saw, I don't know, eight movies in 24 hours. And there was Xenocrity in them. The one on the plane was, the incredible thing, I told James this, is that in the hotel coming back from the beach, I saw the Bourne Ultimatum.
Oh yeah, I didn't see that.
You gotta see it. It's literally Walter's Operation Mind Control book.
Oh yeah.
And I'm watching it 3 days after he died, and I'm thinking, geez, this is the movie he wanted to make. You know, they did it. And Robert Ludlum gets all the credit. I checked out the Wikipedia last night. Ludlum wrote that book in 1990. So he had lots of time to absorb Walter, talk it up, get his thing going. And
you think he met Walter?
No, but he had time to think about it. And apparently
he read Walter's book.
He must have, because he's born, there's three books. The first, they say all three are totally different.
Yeah.
It's the third one. I don't know what the first two novels were like, but he sold them and made lots of money with his novel and the movie. But he picked the MK Ultra story for the third one. So that was like he had to get the normal kind of shit out first, and then he went to this controversial topic. Yeah. So that was all, it was interesting studying this movie and then thinking about Walter and then checking out the Wikipedia last night and just how all this Walter stuff, how Hollywood ripped it off. And they did it when they wanted to do it, when it didn't matter. 20 years after MK Ultra's lockdown, everybody's conditioned, right? They reveal it 20 years later. So, synchronistically, Walter died, and I felt, well, Walter said, Bob, you gotta see this movie, you know? So, he forced me to see it 3 days later. So he forced the plane to fuck up so that I'd be stuck overnight, because I would not normally go to see these things.
Yeah.
So, then I watched Hairspray on the plane, and I watched this movie called Hot Rod. You ever seen Hot Rod?
I don't think so.
Very funny movie. It's an idiot guy who's trying to be an Evel Knievel in suburbia. Mm-hmm. But it's like those Kevin Smith movies. You know Kevin Smith's movies? Anyways, I recommend Hot Rod. It was pretty interesting, though. The humor of this. I mean, I was thinking, man, you're going to die when you watch this. It has a bit of that slapstick stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third movie was Stardust. You said you liked that movie, right? Stardust.
No, it was the other Nancy.
The song.
Oh, Nancy Shaw. No, it was Nancy Shaw.
We were listening to Stardust.
Right. And that was interesting, Xenocrony, but I won't go into it. But Andrew and I saw a movie when we went to see Scott Eastham in Palmerston, which was a 6-hour ride.
Mm-hmm.
Eastern Promises, Cronenberg's new movie.
Oh, I would like to see that. Always up for Cronenberg.
I said, what did he do before? What was the movie before?
Well, there was that one that...
Car Crash or something.
Oh, yeah, there was Crash. I'm not sure. I said, for some reason,
it was.
Oh yeah, History of Violence. History of Violence is the name of his movie. Big deal a year or two ago, which I think was about the top-down media, the bottom-up media effect, media violence, and how it's like a takeoff on the Bush era. Everybody loves the violence.
Wasn't there one called like Experience, but it was like
no Existence.
Yeah, but it was with an X.
Yeah, and that was about Carol.
Right.
That's about 2000.
Right.
That was his response to The Matrix.
Yeah.
But it was a very small little version, no side effect. So History of Violence is the media, is the Bush era, people loving violence in the media. That's what I think he was commenting on, but I haven't seen it. So I said to Andrew, well, this one has to be top down. And it'll be about the Bush people, and it's called Eastern Promises, so it's about the KGB Bolsheviks in the Dr. Peterson era taking over the Pentagon. I said, this is what it'll have to be about, assuming the Xenocrony of Bob Xenocrony is going to happen. We went, and it's exactly what it is. So,
except they didn't characterize it as KGB and Bolsheviks, did they?
It's KGB and London Mafia. London Mafia is Bolshevik control.
Well,
so at one level, it's KGB taking over the Rockefeller cartel. Rockefeller's Mafia. KGB is another level, state socialist KGB. So it totally fit. And
this is the new Cronenberg.
Yeah, so I recommend it. It's pretty interesting.
Cool.
Eastern Promises. So that's all I wanted to say about that. So, James.
You're the only guy I know who can say, yeah, I went to the beach to meet these two guys, and, you know, I never did meet them, but it's still a good story.
Well, the whole fucking thing was, hey, Andrew, I got delayed, but guess what? I went to Maroubra Beach. And he has not, I've been waiting 2 days, he has not responded. I don't think he believes me. I think he has too. Because I went to the beach and looked for him, studied for an hour, and, you know, writing this. And I said, having learned a lot in your surfing course, I could figure out what it was, and I felt very confident after an hour observing the scene like an anthropologist. So I went looking for the Averton brothers.
What do you say?
He's probably have to go there before he responds. If I don't,
I don't know why. Maybe he's busy. It's Christmas, but usually he would respond. He might write cool or something, but he has responded. I'm thinking he thinks I'm putting him on. You know, I don't know. And then I said, after I went to the beach, I went to Mr. Magurian's Emporium. That's a new movie with Dustin Hoffman, and we were going to watch that when we were at his cottage, but we didn't. So I went to it just to see, because he decided I was Mr. Magoo. You know the cartoon character,
yeah.
Magoo?
Yeah, based on your prowess with technical things.
You heard it when we talked about with Michael Emmons on our internet.
Yeah.
Yeah. The thing, Mr. Magoo is his cartoon character.
He just called you Magoo for short.
Yeah, Magoo. And, you know, Magoo is a guy who goes around, bumps into the walls, and he can't do anything, but everything happens perfectly for him, you know? He's got total something. So Andrew, watching me try to hook up with you guys and with the computer, and I wasn't in the mood to do anything, I didn't do anything. And he was watching my total computer illiteracy, and he couldn't fucking believe how bad it was, you know? But I was exaggerating it, you know? Like, where do you put this little arrow, Andrew? You know, the browser arrow? Because, what do you mean? I said, well, I don't know. I just watched Carolyn and she ain't here, so... So he said, well, you point it up there. Okay. Oh, a little menu coming. Oh, that's neat. Now what? Well, hit that. Oh, I hit shutdown. Oh, damn. That's why I created his own stupidity scene. And he thought it was real, and he couldn't find it. And he complained. He mentioned it to you guys. Right, we get on. And he mentioned in brief the Magoo thing, right?
Yeah.
He announced me as Magoo. And Michael Adams says, that's just the beginning. He warned him, because I'd been at Michael's for 5 weeks. And he said, Michael says, Andrew, get ready. That's just the beginning, man. You will never be the same after Dobbs is at your place. So I got called Magoo. We saw Mr. Magorium. He's kind of like a Magoo, or we thought it was Magoo in the title. So I go to it, and he's totally a Magoo guy. He's a magician. He's been alive for 285 years. He's running this toy shop. It's sort of a kid's movie, but an adult movie.
Thank you.
And it's a really... It was and his had a D-cell. The whole thing was a little cube.
Who had a D-cell?
Mr. Magoo. He had a D-cell.
Oh, really?
It was a magical device. But it's not a cartoon. It's about a 285-year-old man who's been running a toy shop, which all the kids come in, and all the toys do these incredible things. What are you talking about?
Mr. Magoo was cartoon.
Mr. Magoo is a cartoon.
Okay. Oh, okay, you're talking about the
Magoo's Emporium.
Dustin Hoffman.
The new movie, because he thought, he saw the title, we picked Bra Boys rather than this. And I didn't really want it. I think it was maybe in Palmerston North, where we picked Eastern Promises and not Magoo's Emporium. But he wanted Magoo's Emporium because he said, well, this is probably about you, Bob, about the Magoo aspect. Yeah. It's called the Mr. Magorium. Mr. Magorium's Emporium, I think that's the title. But he saw Magoo in it, but we didn't watch it. So then I decided to watch it the night I was in Sydney. And it's all about a Magoo character, sort of. He's totally a magical guy. He's been around for a long time, 285 years old. And the kids come in stores, and all the toys do, they all come alive and talk and do amazing things for the kids.
Yeah.
And the woman, maybe it was Naomi Watts or someone, who's working for him and wants to be a concert pianist, she likes the place, but wants to move on. But he's decided that he had bought so many shoes 150 years ago. He bought this one shoe that he loved. And he says, I'll wear this shoe for the rest of my life. So he bought, let's say, 100 pairs. And he said, I will die when I run out of my last pair. So it was his last pair. And they had holes in them. And he said, I got to go. And they said, what do you mean you got to go? You've been here all this time. So he was trying to convince them he's leaving tomorrow. And so she has all this identity crisis, and the chartered accountant comes in to look at they have to do the books to figure it out, and the guy is a spitting image of Andrew Crystal, the actor, who was unbelievable, and he had the same facial reactions to things that I did, because he's an accountant, he's a practical guy, he ignores all the magic, doesn't even see all the magic going on, you know, and he's totally a straight guy, and so much... his facial expressions were much like Andrew in dealing with me. Not that Andrew's a chartered accountant, but his facial expressions were exactly...
Yeah, he's a very clean, collegiate-looking guy.
Yeah, and So I'm watching Andrew Crystal in the movie encountering Mr. Magoo. You know what I mean? How's that for synchrony? So it's about how he starts to realize something's going on, and the girl doesn't want to deal with the death, and then there's a little genius kid, and he does all kinds of neat things. It was a pretty interesting, neat movie. Great toy stuff.
And Dustin Hoffman was a magician.
He was Mr. Magoo. And so, but in the end, he said, you've got to learn how to do, you're going to take over the storage, you don't want to take over the storage, you've got to deal with this wooden block. And one thing led to another, and he died, and he was closed down the store. The store died. All the toys went gray, and they were all bleak, and she was selling it. And then the accountant guy, the Andrew Chris guy, says, what about this block of wood? And she's, nah, it's a bunch of shit. I don't know how to work it. And so she's complaining, and she says, she says something positive, like, I like the cube, but I don't know how to work. And so when she goes, I like the cube moved. And the accountant sees it. What the? They say that again. I like you. If I can move. Hey, look. And so she sees it. So then it starts dancing all over the place, and then it becomes the magic place. And the key to the whole environment. And then it all revives, and then she takes over the store. And Mr. and the accountant's all happy again. You know? Or he's become, he now realizes there's magic. So I cite that because halfway through my stay with Andrew, he goes, Bob, you're fucking blowing my mind. Are you human?
Got to that point. Are you a fucking human being?
This is what he had to deal with. It was just like in the movie, because the accountant couldn't believe what was going on. Right. Anyways, it was, without going into all details, it was very funny, and this movie is totally a mirror of what I just been through with the actor looking exactly like Andrew. Wow. Incredible, same facial expressions. The New Zealanders are interesting looking people. Mm-hmm. To me, they all looked like freckle faced. Slightly suntanned, rustic farmer people. And it might be because they're all Irish, Scottish, and British, and it's all mixed in. Mm-hmm. And Andrew told me that the... Hey, Terry, you hearing this? You might want to hear this.
I was making something to drink.
Well, don't. Let me tell you this.
Well, wait a minute. Just because you don't drink, does anybody like something to drink, like some...
Sure.
Pineapple juice with sparkling water, that sounds good, or if you want...
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah, that sounds great.
But I just want you to hear this fact, Terry.
Okay.
Andrew, remember, it's on tape.
I know, but he may not catch the game. You will in the editing.
He will.
Andrew told me that the New Zealand girls are the most promiscuous girls in the world. And it's like
why
a
did
sticker.
You have to tell him that?
Yeah, just to get your attention. anyways, it was really a great country, very interesting place. Mm-hmm. It was like Nova Scotia. It was incredible. You'd be surfing on the beach, and there'd be a mountain there, a mountain, with evergreens and deciduous and Canadian trees. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a very odd thing, you know. You're there with winter. To me, winter trees. In the Pacific Ocean. Wow. In the South Pacific, and there was this island out there, and when the tide went down, we one day walked out. I'd been there 2 weeks, and I'm walking out the low tide towards this amazing forestry with all these little cotton ball kind of trees. It's all snug, and you can't get up in there, so gnarly. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at it, it's just very neat. And I go, this is just like a movie I saw about the South Pacific. And he goes, Bob, you are in the South Pacific. He goes, Bob, you are in the South Pacific. I go, fucking right. I go, yeah. I'm looking at all this through movie images. And then I had to say, well, wait a minute. You know, it's first, second nature. The one I'm looking through, that's all I know about that shit. And tried to rationalize why I couldn't see first nature. But he insisted that I have to see the first nature. I wasn't seeing the first nature. And I was joking about seeing through the movies, but it was pretty, he couldn't believe it. It took Bob 2 fucking weeks to realize where he was. So,
how was it meeting his thesis advisor?
A very, very important meeting.
Do you guys want to go and sit out there where it's warm and nice outside?
Well, I don't know. Just want to continue here about Andrew.
Why was this a very important meeting?
Thesis advisor.
I'll have to tell you that. That's a. I don't know if we'll get. And I won't say that right now. Maybe we'll go outside for that story.
Oh, all right. But you did meet him.
Something about interacting with the.
Did you go there to help?
Yeah, 6-8 hour fucking drive.
To help.
Yeah, it all worked. I helped him. He had to apply for a job.
Apply for a job.
He went down. Okay. I'm not going to go into it yet. I'll get to that. I want to finish this thought I was saying about New Zealanders and two
You just discovered you were in the South Pacific movie.
Right. And so I suddenly, so I'm thinking I'm in the goddamn South Pacific. And I was then, what, you know what I did?
No.
You have to. Okay. He didn't realize. I pointed something. You want me to realize I'm in the South Pacific. Okay. I'm going to have to think of images I have of the South Pacific to see where I am.
Uh-huh.
You want me to pick other kinds of imagery, not a movie imagery. But I still have to fucking think of imagery to say where I am, because I said I ain't nowhere. This is the incredible thing about where he lives.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Yeah. The world's day begins in New Zealand.
Oh, my God.
That's what's incredible. You got the dateline that wiggles down the globe. And it, the first, if you look at the world clock, the first time is Chatham Island. So here's the zigzaggy thing. Here's Australia. Here's New Zealand. Chatham Island is the first. It's like at 1 o'clock in the morning is Chatham Island, and then New Zealand right there is maybe an hour and a half later, 45 minutes later. So it's the second time. But for civilization, it's the beginning of the day. It begins in New Zealand.
Wow.
And so then, so I was fixating on that before realizing the movie, because we went to the laundromat one day, and I'm looking at this incredible map, sort of New Zealand centric, just laid out flat, but you're looking right at New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to see all the Solomon Islands, the Polynesia, mm-hmm. the Indonesia, and finally could see it. Like, it's a whole big blind spot for northerners. We don't know that area. We heard words, Guam mm-hmm. and all that. But and so I was really focusing on where everything was, and I said, shit, New Zealand is down here. I thought it was up there.
Mm-hmm.
That being Australia, I thought it was up there, but that's actually New Guinea, mm-hmm. and New Zealand's down here. And New Zealand is the lowest point in the fucking world next to Antarctica.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And so you're right there, but because the sun comes up kind of like on an angle, it doesn't shine all along the date line. The day doesn't begin from the north all the way to the Antarctica.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, you can say you're the first sunlight there.
Mm.
Is it up in Japan? No, they're on a different angle, so they get the sunlight a little later. So the sunlight, the first place to be lit is Andrew's place, you know, which is really interesting when you think about it. So I was absorbing that this is the beginning of the day for the world, because we're a day ahead of you guys.
No.
You know, technical visual space term.
No.
And so meditating on that for a while, and then one day when he said, Bob, you have to realize you're at the end of the world. He was complaining about the northern hemisphere civilizations have no respect or never include the south. And I found in one of the Sheila Watson McLuhan letters, McLuhan is asked about South Africa literature. He says, there isn't any South Africa literature, says McLuhan. Andrew says, there's my point. There's the northern bias. They don't think anything's going on down here in the southern hemisphere.
Mm-hmm.
And so he went on about this. And so one day, it was when we were walking, and he was complaining about me not realizing I was in the South Pacific. I said, well, you say we're at the end. We're not in the fucking end of the world. We're right here, wherever here is. It's only you bring the visual space, the clock measurement, and you make a ratio that we're here, and that's the world, the day behind, all that you think you're at the end. Well, you're not at the end of the world. And I said, what was it like growing up here? Did you guys think that you were at the end of the world as a kid? He said, no, we were just here. I said, that's my point. You're not anywhere. You're not at the end of the world. But you got this psychological thing. And I said, that is a reality, because everybody lives in second nature culture, visual space, and think this. So we had this ongoing dialogue about where the fuck were we? You know what I mean? And he had his problem about the northern attitude, and I didn't even know I was in the fucking south, because basically I was running around. I had just taken a subway train, a long subway ride, got on a fucking tunnel, went, sat there, and then I landed somewhere else. And it's like if I took a subway ride from Toronto to Montreal, it might take 5 hours. Well, it takes the same fucking amount of time going from San Francisco to Maui. You know what I mean? You're in an airport, you get in the thing, then you sleep, and then you're standing on the ground again. It's another place. So you have no sense of going anywhere. And so we were talking about that. He agreed to that. And so I said, probably took me, you know, many weeks to realize I'd gone somewhere. Even though it was a 13-hour plane ride. So we were studying all these fucking weird effects, you know, and cross-cultural. Like, I could, many times, I didn't know what he was fucking saying.
And the accent?
Yeah, the accent. And I couldn't tell, like, he might say baby, but I would hear fubby or something, you know. Mm-hmm. It's just some, the M and the B's, they kind of merge. And so I said, when I talk, do you find it easy to hear? Yeah, I have no problem. I said, well, when I hear you talk, even though you're speaking English, I can't, your accent alters it. I can't hear it. And so we were wondering about what that, why that would be. Mm-hmm. And he says, well, he can understand English better. It's not a problem because it's in all the movies. He lives in English. Mm. We don't live in a New Zealand accent.
You know, I noticed when we got online and you were introducing us to each other, the first thing he says is, was he mentioned his Aussie, you know, what do you think of my Aussie accent? And I thought, well, how come you're the one with the accent? How come I'm not the one with the accent?
Yeah, that's what you thought. Well, that got answered later, that he's inside the Golden Village. He's getting the English dominating. He lives in English language, in his media.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we're not an accent.
So he feels like an outsider.
yeah, he had this whole outsider thing. And in one level, it is fascinating. They are at the bottom of the world. They are at the end of the world, you know. And the development there is not that big. Auckland, normal city highways. Very quickly, like when he picked me up at the airport at midnight, we get out of Auckland, and we're going through this windy fucking road, and it's very narrow, and the traffic coming is very narrow. It's very frightening in terms of what you're used to. And someone I met said, somebody's mother, I don't know, someone here since I came back, said, oh yeah, the bus driver in Australia going to the beach, the first bus driver gets me to the subway. He says, you're not from around here? I said, no, New York. He says, yeah, I live in Seattle. He was a Fijian from Fiji, a black guy from Fiji. And he went up in Seattle. But he said, hey, we're driving along, he says, hey, do you notice the roads are very dangerous here? And I go, yeah, I did. And in New Zealand, I described how there's the snow. They just whip along these curves, and they're going around blind curves, and they all are used to not hitting each other, but the trucks are coming by, to me, real close. I mean, there was 100 potential accidents going down to Scott Eastham's place, because we're on this widening road all the time. Mm-hmm. So it's primitive sort of...
And aren't they on the other side of the street? They're driving...
Oh, yeah, that's the opposite. I didn't have any problem with that for some reason, but I kept...
because you weren't driving.
Right, no, but what I did, every time we'd get out and then we go back to the car, I go over to the normal Gideon on the right side, passenger side, and I kept going there. Like, oh, yeah, and I go back and sit. That, he found that very funny, that I kept thinking I had to sit on the right side, even though it wasn't odd driving. I don't know why. I don't know.
You don't drive anyway.
Yeah, I don't drive, but... there was something. Did we do left-hand driving in Maui?
No.
I had some reason why.
That causes accidents among tourists.
Have you ever driven a car, Bob?
Not in 18 years. Last time I just got my license renewed in Toronto. I was up there, but I haven't been driven since '89.
You haven't driven a car since 1989, and even since you renewed your license.
Right, I just renew it for ID purposes or whatever. It's a nice bureaucratic thing, and I was 2 years out of date or behind. But I can only do it in Toronto. But anyways, so we're talking about the highway, and so the bus driver says that when he and his wife went to Seattle, they lived in Sydney, and she had no problem driving in Sydney. And he goes to Seattle, bigger highways. She said, he said, we came back to Sydney, she won't drive on the highway anymore. It's too narrow. She got used to the wide thing, and Sydney is like Auckland, like New Zealand. And even he found it difficult again, and he's a bus driver, but he's the one, he's driving along, and he says to me, you notice how fucking wacky these roads are? I mean, he mentioned it, and I had been thinking about it in New Zealand, so that was cute. But what else? Okay, so Andrew, we're doing this driving thing, and... maybe that was the whole story. The way the roads are is sort of third worldy. Oh, when I flew in, what was amazing, and it was a beautiful evening, was the land.